bird is freed. Elon Musk has apparently taken over Twitter.
And he's Twitter Blue will roll out November 29th to make sure it is cool.
There could be a new round of firings targeting the sales and partnership side.
Twitter employees have rejected Elon Musk's, quote, hardcore ultimatum. And there's a mass exodus.
Elon Musk took over Twitter and the place is it's a mess.
A snapshot of the chaos that has engulfed Twitter after Elon Musk officially took it over in late October. The chaos is bleeding into his main business. Tesla's stock price has dropped by half this year. He sold billions of dollars worth of Tesla shares to shore up Twitter's bleak finances. Advertisers are fleeing Twitter as he welcomes back banned accounts and flirts with QAnon. Here to talk about all this is Drew Harwell, tech reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Drew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so I'm just wondering, when you go on Twitter, has the experience changed for the average user in the last couple of months?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, for some people, maybe not, but I think you're seeing a lot more of the, you know, wild kind of far-right people who were suspended many moons ago and that have been brought back by Elon, and many of them are feeling energized to sort of say the things that they couldn't say under an old regime. And so you're starting to see a lot more kind of extreme things, or even seeing in some cases more hate speech. And it's just a really different experience now that Elon has taken over under this, you know, banner of free speech absolutism.
Right. And so he's actually saying a lot of these controversial and hateful things himself and energizing this side.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he's the main sort of megaphone for a lot of this stuff. He's sharing conspiracy theories. He's sharing anti-Fauci, anti-pandemic, pandemic, anti-vaccines, stuff about, you know, Nancy Pelosi's husband, sort of sharing kind of bogus theories about that. And so he has really become sort of the, you know, extreme voice in chief, giving a lot of, you know, people cover to say the same things and echoing him.
Yeah, on Sunday, I think he tweeted, "My pronouns are prosecute Fauci," which is anti-trans and anti everything, anti-vax, anti-science,
and kind of threatening. Tacky, right? And it's just like, yeah, it's just odd to hear an executive of a company talk like that. But that's who he is. He is the master troll.
Right. So what does that do to the far right and to QAnon when he tweets something like that? Or as he also tweeted, this white rabbit emoji. What is all that?
So, you know, some of it is very overt. What he's saying is very conspiratorial. Some of it is a little more implicit. Yeah, he shared a tweet that was "follow the white rabbit" with a rabbit emoji. And of course, the white rabbit, the rabbit hole, it's something from Alice in Wonderland. It's from The Matrix. So maybe it's totally harmless, but it's also kind of a really original indicator that QAnon people would share amongst themselves. It was, you know, the rabbit hole was going to show you how deep the deep state went and how, you know, the world is really run by, of course, this Satanist cabal of Democrats who ate children, all of this totally nonsense stuff. And so when he posted that, a lot of QAnon people thought, like, okay, he's winking directly at us. This is him saying, he's one of us. We can keep talking like we're talking. And of course, you know, Elon sort of made a joke about it, like he wasn't meaning it in that way. But this is sort of textbook trolling online, right? You're ambiguous. You have this plausible deniability. You're angering people. You're getting people outraged and getting attention for yourself, most importantly. And so Elon has really kind of fed that. He's really been incentivized to get people talking about him, no matter what the cost of what he's saying is.
Well, it's a big cost when you look at what's happening at Tesla. So you have investors at Tesla begging him to stop doing this and to get back to running his company.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tesla's stock price is down by half this year. That is a lot of burnt money. And, you know, the people who bought stock in Tesla, a lot of them are, you know, we will say fairly liberal, right? Like they believe in the mission of electric cars. They believe in this really cool sort of sci-fi, you know, mandate that Elon had been all about for many years. And so the fact that this business that they've poured money into is now attached to this kooky, far-right, you know, free speech crusade that Elon is dragging them into. There's a lot of frustration among Tesla people that they feel like no matter what they do, no matter how good their personal business is, you know, the business they've invested in, it's now sort of dragged down by Elon's circus over at Twitter.
Yeah, and I guess it's maybe not just the investors, but the people who buy the cars. They're probably more liberal than your average car buyer. So what are they thinking? I don't want to buy another Tesla, or I want to sell my Tesla?
There is that contingent of people who is saying that, right? Like, this badge on my car, I may not believe in right now. You know, Elon Musk has become such a polarizing character. And of course, there are people who still love him and who think, you know, he's taking down the media. He's taking down, you know, the leftists in Washington. I support this. There are those people. And yet others just feel like, you know, another culture war. I'm so tired of seeing Elon talk like this. I never meant to attach myself to this. And so it's really becoming, you know, a PR problem for Elon. Not to mention, you know, Twitter needs money all of its own, right? It relies on advertising. It wants companies to give it money so, you know, it can put its brand next to stuff that they want online and get attention. They don't want to be attached to some white supremacist QAnon, you know, crazy stuff. So I think that battle between Tesla and Twitter and Elon is going to really sort of ramp up as his posting continues.
So I guess everyone's wondering, what's the master plan here? What is he doing? Why is he doing all this? Any answers?
I have no crystal ball. I think his main interest is attention for himself. I mean, he is a star. He loves the celebrity of taking over Twitter and being all that anyone talk about. What the business? Oh, there are some specifics of the business of Twitter that need to happen, like getting advertisers and keeping people on the platform and paying money, that I don't think, you know, winking to QAnon really accomplish. Elon has been doing this, certainly has a lot more money than I do, so maybe he has something up his sleeve. But I think a lot of people who know him and who talk to us or who are, you know, attached to the company just feel like a lot of this is chaos. It's just sort of he's trying to sort of yuck it up with people in a way that's maybe tearing his businesses down.
Drew Harwell, tech reporter for The Washington Post. Drew, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, political writer Wajahat Ali was told many times in his life to go back to where he came from. He's from California. So he wrote a book called Go Back to Where You Came From and other helpful recommendations for how to become American. Our conversation is next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 2022 is finally coming to an end. And as we head into our final shows of the year, we wanted to revisit some of our favorite interviews of 2022. First up, my conversation with the political writer and commentator Wajahat Ali. I spoke to him back in February about his memoir that had just come out. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations for How to Become American. Ali, who was born in the Bay Area to Pakistani immigrants, told me that someone hurls that insult at him, go back to where you came from, almost daily.
There's usually two hallmark emails I get. Very lovely unsolicited recommendations. Number one is, go back to where you came from, you Arab. And I'm like, I'm not Arab. I'm a Pakistani stock. And do you want me to go back to the womb or Fremont, California? I would love to if you could subsidize the rent. And the second one I get all the time is, go F a goat or a camel. And I'm always just like slightly offended because they only choose goats and camels. And I'm like, there's a huge animal kingdom. Why only those two animals? I really want like a nerd listening. If you're a researcher, research why they're really fascinated with just those two animals. Like, it's never like a llama or like, you know, like a cat. It's goat and camel. So I get those two helpful recommendations almost on a daily basis.
So how do you just brush it off and find humor in that? It's pretty vicious and hateful.
Yeah, I mean, that's the title of the book, right? It's a gut punch, because many of us who are born and raised in this country, or many of us who consider ourselves American, are reminded almost daily that we don't belong, right? You're a suspect and an other in your own country. You're both us and them. And that those hateful words, they hit people differently, right? Some people just get triggered, and rage is perfectly fine, anger, sadness, tears. But I'm not one to cry. So you can either laugh or cry, and I choose to respond. And so oftentimes ignoring is a response, because life is too short. And if you respond to all the anger and hate, you know, racism gets exhausting. But sometimes I respond, like in the title, or like I just did right now, with humor. Because humor, I think if deployed with intention, you can disrupt and flatten your opponent. You can booby trap those stereotypes. And also it allows for catharsis, a relief, and allows you to smile. And we need joy in life.
Yeah. Yeah, Aristotle knew that.
Yeah, there you go. Look at you, you nerd.
Going back to that. Well, I guess I'm wondering if you ever convince anyone, if you have people who are so racist and angry, do you ever disarm them successfully?
I don't know if I disarm them successfully, but what I do know is that they listen to me. You know, I've done this a lot my entire life, you know, for 20 years, especially if you're a Muslim in America in the ongoing and endless war on terror, you're asked to condemn violent acts done by violent people you've never met, and you're asked to prove your moderation in front of a very skeptical judge, jury, and audience that always holds you as suspect and indicts you and convicts you anyway. And so the bar is really low. And also when it comes to if you're Muslimy or Pakistani, they don't expect us to be like smart or funny or witty or know pop culture. I'm serious. They think we're like knuckle draggers who just discovered how to be bipedal. So if you come out and you speak English properly, and if you're not angry and you could be funny, like literally people have told me, I'm not making this up. I'm talking about educated, liberal, Ivy League educated folks. There's one guy who once told me, I didn't know Muslims could be funny. And then he made this face. I'm like, why not? He goes, I always thought they were very, you know, very, I'm like, constipated. He goes, no, just like serious and sober. And so I feel like sometimes people like me are sometimes very threatening to folks because they can't dismiss us as an Osama or a Saddam. And oftentimes people like me can also help. I think if you use humor and you use bluntness and you engage folks in a conversation, what humor sometimes does is it releases endorphins, which scientifically has shown that people become more susceptible, Madeline, at least to entertaining otherwise hostile conversations, especially on politics and culture and religion, that they otherwise would not entertain. And that's where I can Trojan horse maybe a couple of gems.
But you, it is a funny book and a funny memoir in many, many places, but it's also not in many, many places. It's also very serious and filled with trauma. You write about almost dying a couple of times and the kind of curse on your family. Your family has also suffered a lot of calamities. And you write about how, as you said just earlier, how exhausting racism is and having to be, in your case, a representative of a model minority. And one line really stuck out in terms of that in one of your earlier chapters when you write, the system turns us into enforcers and defenders of whiteness, promising success and safety in exchange for loyalty and obedience. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. It's the dangerous and toxic model minority myth in which you too can become American if you just bootstrap yourself and you smile wide with your white teeth showing and you don't complain and you're grateful and you nod along. And especially you Asians, you brown folks and those from China and Vietnam, you guys are the good ones. You came here, you worked hard, you didn't complain, and you have good spelling, and you get good credit, and you get a good job, and you get a good degree, and you're not white, and you know you're not white, but you get close to whiteness. And why can't these blacks and these poor browns and these other refugees just model themselves like you and stop complaining? See, you blacks and you browns, There's not a racist society. There's no white supremacy. This system works. Look at this Asian who's vice president. And look at this brown kid who got into Stanford. And then the mall minority says, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we're special. We're the good ones. See, blacks and browns, how come you can't be like us? And that's how we cape for whiteness and we become enforcers of white supremacy, because we delude ourselves into believing this myth of the American dream, of exceptionalism, of bootstrapping yourself, of moderation. But there's a cost to it. We give up so much. We give up our voice. We give up our anger. We give up being the co-protagonist of our own narrative, the American narrative. We become sidekicks of our own narrative. We become invisible, and we're happy for it because we get close to whiteness and away from blackness. But the cost also is that we fail to realize that this country, no matter how hard you worked, no matter how white your teeth were, will turn on you on a dime overnight. It's not enough.
Which you discovered after 9/11.
I always knew it, right? But there's something about knowing something and reading about something versus experiencing it, correct? So I went to UC Berkeley. I was a 20-year-old, you know, the woke student at that time. I hate that word, but you know what I mean. Like, you know, educated, kind of liberal in your politics, but still, I think, a suburban kid who had a very lucky, privileged life, who went from high school then to UC Berkeley. And you read about this stuff, but you don't necessarily experience it. There's a difference between being a spectator and being an active participant in the American nightmare that is lived and experienced and not survived by many folks. And I remember it was the 9/11 terror attack that brought down the towers was the first baptism by fire for my generation, the turning point, where overnight, boom, Muslims and anyone who looked Muslimy was the target, right? Islam was the enemy, axis of evil, us versus them. And you're simultaneously both us and them. And then fast forward 8 months after the 9/11 terror attacks, my parents were arrested. And I leave school. I'm the only child. I have to take care of my grandmothers who are living with me. I have to take care of the family business. I have to find money for the lawyer. My parents are both incarcerated, and overnight realized, oh, this is the America that is lived and experienced by so many. I had 2 feet in 2 different islands, one in the American dream, one in the American nightmare. I had to navigate that schizophrenic reality for about 10 years.
Okay, well, let's talk about your parents being arrested, because they weren't arrested on any suspicion of terrorism. They were arrested.
Thankfully, no.
For something else.
They were, yeah. So what happened was I was, 21 years old now. I was about to graduate UC Berkeley. I was about to go to law school. And my biggest decision, Madeline, was UC Davis or UC Hastings. And I was eating tandoori chicken at Shalimar in the Tenderloin. And I got the call from my aunt who said, your parents have been arrested today. I don't know what's happening, but you should come home and take care of everything. And my parents got swept up in something called Operation Cyberstorm, where I think about 27 people were allegedly part of this massive anti-piracy sting. But the irony is my parents had nothing to do with the counterfeiting. My parents instead had 30 counts against them for this previous work that they did where they sold educational software, Microsoft educational software. So my parents the night before were these, like, you know, upper middle class suburban parents chilling at home. And in the morning at 6 o'clock, like a dozen armed FBI folks came in, ran through the door, dragged them out of bed. And my dad said it was like, you know, he was like treated like a Mexican kingpin. They had no idea what was happening. And they read the counts and my father almost fainted. But what happened was both of them got arrested. And this was in the aftermath of 9/11. And you can imagine that there was immense fear in the Muslim community. People did not want to come near us, right? There was surveillance and there was conspiracy theories. And even in the pre-trial hearing, the U.S. attorney said, we have found books in Arabic, in Urdu. And do you know, they're from Pakistan. And the Taliban are also in Pakistan. And thankfully, the judge cut them off. So it was under that climate that this happened. And overnight, the money was gone. The assets were gone. Community was gone. And my mom said it best, everything we touched turned to dust.
Hmm. But you write that they made some pretty dumb and shady business decisions. They weren't on the level of a Mexican drug kingpin, but...
No, I think I was very fair in the book in that I didn't defend them in the book. And I interviewed them and they look back on some of the stuff they did. And they're like, yeah, I could see why that was stupid. But from my parents' perspective, and I mentioned this in the book, they didn't think they were doing anything illegal and they had finished the business and moved on with their life. Like, they were kind of confused as to what had happened. Does that make sense? It's like if you do something illegal and you know you're doing something illegal, you sleep with one eye open. And ignorance of the law isn't an excuse, but like they had literally moved on. This was like a business they did a year and a half ago. They had taken the money, started a new business. They were living their life. And then just imagine someone gut punching you. That's how they felt. And my parents, because they felt so innocent, or they felt like the 30 counts against them were BS. They made the decision, and bad decision in hindsight. They're like, it's my name. Why should I accept guilt over my name? And I can empathize with them. So they decided to fight back, and they appealed the case. And so for what happened is that case was in limbo for 9 years as they appealed the case. And there was like a sword hanging over our head, my head, for 9 years, because if they had won the appeal, hooray. But if they had lost the appeal, everything would turn to dust again. And as I mentioned in the book, they were initially in prison for a year. And then I finally got them out. They got out. They rebuilt themselves. They climbed back up, you know, the immigrant hustle. They got back in the house. I eventually went to law school. I became a playwright and a writer. We thought everything was going well. We're like, wow, this appeal's taking a long time. Maybe the courts are really considering it. And then right before I turned 30, they lose the appeal. Overnight, my dad gets arrested. My mother is given 6 months to report to prison. I lose everything again. I drive my mother to prison, which was very surreal. And the irony was that everyone thought I was crushing it, Madeline. All my friends said, you made it, Wajahat. You're the playwright. You're the writer. Meanwhile, I was homeless and living in hell.
Oh my gosh.
Which was so weird. It was like the Twilight Zone episode from hell. Like, I didn't know if it was a comedy or a horror movie.
Yeah, it sounds awful. Super traumatizing. And do you think that, well, had they not been, you know, brown-skinned immigrants from Pakistan, they would have been dealt with much differently by the judicial system?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, my parents definitely think that. They're like, you know, we were small brown Muslim fish after 9/11, and we didn't have the money, and we didn't have the right complexion or the connections, and they screwed us, and they made an example out of us. They being the U.S. government and Microsoft, right? And I feel like my parents, you know, they're not bitter. If you read the book, you'll see that they have a clear-eyed, optimistic look on life. And the book also talks about their awakening, right? Like, they were the model minority stereotype, but they go to prison. And my mom says, I noticed that most of my, you know, colleagues or inmates, I guess you could say, in prison, those who were incarcerated, were just, you know, women of color who just needed a second chance. They were just poor, and they were in there for drugs. And they were good women who just, no one cared about them, and the system just ate them up. And in a strange way, it humbled them, but also gave them insight as to how racist and cruel the criminal justice system is, and how there's a double standard, and how being the model minority means nothing when you're automatically made into them overnight.
You end the book on a really hopeful note for yourself and for America. And there is this really beautiful passage you cite from the Quran that says, if the hour, the day of resurrection, is about to be established and one of you was holding a palm shoot, let him take advantage of even 1 second before the hour is established to plant it. What does that mean?
Yeah, plant a seed. Plant a seed. It means, you know, even if you see the day of judgment, plant a seed. Even if you see the four horsemen of the apocalypse riding and you have time, plant the seed. Do something with your hands to invest in something. Have hope. And I feel like sometimes that earned hope that I'm talking about is not that saccharine Hallmark, you know, ribbon Hollywood ending. That hope sometimes comes through pain, through scars, through acknowledging the warts, right? It's like you go through the forest and you survive the demons and you still keep standing. There's something about that that's very powerful. I'm still here. I'm still alive. I still have time. There's a pandemic that's flattened us, unequally, but has flattened us. And I don't know what will happen in the future, but I've lived enough of this thing called life, and hopefully I've shown you enough examples that sometimes when you turn the page, it brings with it a plot twist, and the story doesn't have to end in misery. Sometimes your daughter does survive cancer. Sometimes your parents do get out of jail. Sometimes you realize you're not broken, and the pain and the wounds heal, and you have the scars, yes, but you also now have memories and experiences, and the pain can be replaced with joy. And just because your story began, you know, in a painful way, doesn't mean it has to end that way as well. And I think that's the power of hope. And that's what we need right now. We need to invest in hope and joy because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But because the alternative, Madeline, is apathy and cynicism. And that means you have resigned yourself to being a spectator.
Yeah. I mean, if you're alive, you've got to do something or it's too painful. We didn't talk about your daughter, but I do want to know, is she okay now? Your daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer when she was 2 years old.
Yeah, my daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer right before she turned 3, 8 months before the pandemic. The cancer went all over her liver, and she needed a full liver transplant. And initially, we had no idea if she was going to survive because she had to endure every single, you know, just type of setback imaginable. And thankfully, you know, due to just people's kindness, you know, I think I mentioned that story towards the end because sometimes I said, sometimes some people can do good, right? I had people tell me, literally, quote, "I hate everything you tweet, but I'm praying for your daughter." I had people say, "I hate your politics, but I signed up to be a donor for your daughter." And I found out that over 500 people, mostly anonymous folks I'd never met, strangers, signed up to be a donor for this little girl they had never met, Nuseba. And we finally got an anonymous donor who then outed himself, Sean Zahir, who stepped up to give a piece of his liver so another girl he had never met could live. And you go through that, and you know, you survive that, and how can you not be hopeful? My daughter is alive. How can I not be hopeful?
And how is she? How old is she now, and how is she doing?
5 years old, cancer-free, knock on wood, sitting right now in virtual school, in her dress, one of three costume changes of the day, with a ribbon in her hair, and I have been informed that I have to buy a very specific Encanto dress, the dress of the older sister, the one who makes, you know, everything into flowers. That's the dress she wants, and I have to find it for her, and if I don't find it for her, I might as well not come back.
Right, so she's basically saying, go back to where you came from if you don't give me that dress.
Yeah. Like, literally, if you do not give me this dress, what use are you, father? Just stay. Come home victorious or come home on your shield.
That's author and political commentator Wajahat Ali. His memoir, which came out earlier this year, is called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations for How to Become American. Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews, including the Avatar sequel.
The story and the writing is so awful that it almost diminishes the awe-inspiring beauty of all the visuals that James Cameron and his team has created.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and it is Thursday. You know what that means. It is film review time, and 13 years after one of the most expensive and highest grossing films of all time debuted, we have its much anticipated sequel to talk about with Amy Nicholson. She hosts the podcast Unspooled and reviews films for the New York Times. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Madeline.
And Sean Edwards, award-winning journalist for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Sean.
Hey, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to both of you. Okay, just a note that I guess no one wanted to open against Avatar, because that's what we're going to be talking about. So that we only have two films to review this week, but we are going to get deep into both of them. So let's begin with Avatar, The Way of Water. Here's a clip.
Dad, I know you think I'm crazy.
Your mind must be gross.
But I feel her. Hear her heartbeat. She's so close.
All right, we have Sam Worthington and Zoe Saldana in the reprising their original roles. Sigourney Weaver is back as well, and then Kate Winslet and Edie Falco join them in this one. Amy, why did it take so long for the sequel to come out?
Well, they had to teach everybody to hold their breath underwater, because that seems like a big deal in this version. This is a big, big sequel with a story that's really not so different from the first Avatar, if you remember what happens in that movie. The first Avatar is all about this marine Jake Sully. He's adjusting to life on Pandora in the trees. And now it's just him and his family. He has a bunch of teenage kids. There's a kind of extended family to get into that have to leave the trees and go live in the water with a different type of Na'vi called the Metkayina. So he just learns everything again. He learns how to swim. He learns how to hold his breath. He learns how to attach his ponytail to a swimming dragon thing. So it's really just another setup for James Cameron to tell a movie that's all about scenes he wants to make. You know, scenes about discovery, scenes about awe, little episodic stories that just kind of feel like Cameron came up with a challenge for himself. Can I invent a new like species that seems like a giant whale and then have my characters swim with it? And he does. And that really feels like the driving force of why he seems to make these Avatar movies at all.
Mm. Sean, remind us what the storyline is from the original, right? This was humans trying to colonize this land, Pandora.
Yeah, because, you know, we humans don't treat planet Earth very well. So Earth is overpopulated. So they're trying to look for another planet that has some natural resources that they can, you know, fly to and steal the resources and bring them back to Earth. But I think Amy really summed this up perfectly. I don't even feel like these Avatar movies are filmed. They seem more like technical training manuals that James Cameron's created to show how gifted he is with the technology that he has at hand. Because the problem with both the movies, especially the sequel, is it's like technology versus everything. I mean, the story and the writing is so awful that it almost diminishes the awe-inspiring beauty of all the visuals that James Cameron and his team has created. Because, you know, I've heard words like James Cameron is a genius and this film is a masterpiece, but how can a film be a masterpiece if the writing is that bad? It took Mr. Cameron 13 years to finally pull off this sequel, but apparently perfecting the script during this elongated time wasn't a part of the process or even a concern.
Wow. So you're saying don't waste your 3 hours plus on this movie.
I'm not saying that. It's impressive. But if you can afford it, just go to Disney World and go on the Avatar Flight of Passage ride. That 3-minute ride is more coherent and more entertaining than this entire bloated movie.
Wow. Okay. Amy, did you have the same feeling that maybe you should save your time and do something else? Knit, maybe, at home?
Well, maybe you could knit while watching the movie. Sean is exactly right. You know, like, it feels like James Cameron really just wants to say a few straightforward, direct things to the audience. You know, like, stop polluting Earth, stop hunting whales. He wants to talk to us basically about Earth, but he puts this Avatar skin on it just to announce these very bold, declarative statements that, you know, maybe he worries nobody wants to hear or that they won't spend 3 hours listening to his message. And in a way, like, this terrible thing about it, the dialogue becomes kind of the best thing about it after a while when your brain starts to break in half. Because, you know, if you remember Jake Sully from the first movie, like, he's a Marine. He talks kind of like a not very educated jock. You know, and here in this movie, his language has been like adopted by his family, by these Na'vi teenagers. So you have these Na'vi teenagers running around and they're just talking like they're on a reality show. You know, they're just like, everything is bro. They're like, yo, bro, 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 bro. To Sean's point that he spent 13 years and just calls everybody bro. Like, I want to almost go down this rabbit hole and think about how he was like, no, really, like, in the evolution of the language with Jake Sully here, we're all going to talk like, you know, Pauly D from Jersey Shore. I found it fascinating.
You think it was really that thought out?
No, but I want to pretend it was just because everything else was.
Well, so apparently there are going to be 3 more Avatar films coming.
No way.
Yeah.
No way. I mean, it's a gorgeous rehash of everything that was great about the first film. Like, the first film triumphed with the visuals, but the first film also failed with the storytelling. And this sequel does the exact same thing. I mean, you could almost do a master class on how bad the storytelling and the script writing is. I mean, you really could. It's that bad.
Oof. Okay, ouch. All right, that's Avatar: The Way of Water, and needless to say, it is in theaters in wide release. Let's turn now to something that is its polar opposite. It's a movie called Io. It's from a Polish filmmaker, and it follows the life of a donkey born in the Polish circus.
Io. Jeśli spełniają twoje wszystkie marzenia. Io!
Oh, okay. So you can kind of make out what's happening there. Sean, this movie shared the jury prize at Cannes. It's by the Polish filmmaker Jerzy Skolimowski. What did you think?
This movie is basically saying the same thing that James Cameron attempted to say in both of his Avatar movies, because it's about this donkey that goes on this incredible journey. Like, it's a donkey on a road trip. You know, he's trying to cross the street and he almost gets hit by a car, and there's foxes and wolves, and like, oh my goodness, are they going to eat him? And it's just this incredible, beautiful story that says, hey, humans, look, animals have feelings and lives too, as he goes on this amazing journey. And it's so cool because it's done in such this creative, artistic way where you don't have to spend $1 billion to make visuals look cool and look great. And in the score, it's like this crazy bonker mix of, you know, there's some EDM music and then there's like classical music and it clashes. And, you know, it's like each little journey is its own small short story strung together as you follow this donkey. For this film to have so little dialogue, it's so very effective. Maybe lessons learned for James Cameron. Like, it's just so much more powerful than anything or everything that was said in Avatar. And I'm sure if I got my hands on this screenplay, I mean, it couldn't have been more than, 2,000 words?
Total. Yeah, it's way shorter than Avatar. Maybe it's half as long.
But it's way more effective emotionally. I mean, you can just feel the, you know, like, you know, everybody wants to give James Cameron this credit for being this passionate filmmaker. No, you can see the passion in this film.
Amy, this is Poland's entry for Best International Film at the Oscars. What did you think?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I love that Sean is making this comparison between this film and Avatar, because, you know, we just had our LAFCA vote, the LA Film Critics, this weekend. And which one of these two won Best Cinematography? It was Io. It was not Avatar. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some interesting backstory here, because, like, Jerzy Skolimowski, he's 84. All the way back in the 60s, when he was in his 20s, he learned that his second film had been voted this number two film of the year by Kaya de Cinema. And he asked them, you know, well, what film was number one? And it was this movie by Robert Bresson called O Hazard Balthazar, which is about a donkey and a girl kind of walking through the countryside. And I love that now, when he's 84, he's kind of made his own take on that movie that he was a little competitive with back then. And while you might think that this plot sounds like cloying, sentimental, it somehow isn't. It's like not patronizing in the slightest. It never really tugs on the heartstrings that hard. It feels, honestly, to me, more punk rock, like modern, like a film done by a guy in his 20s. You know, the music and the visuals and the sound effects are just carrying a lot of weight, and they do it really, really, really well.
So at the world premiere of Avatar, James Cameron said, tonight is not just about a new Avatar film, it's about the cinema itself. And so looking at both of these films that we just reviewed, and obviously you two preferred one over the other, what does it tell you about cinema itself?
James Cameron's statement, I believe, has more to do with the monetary side, because artistically, if cinema is to be saved and if the future of cinema is going to be held in good hands, it will be with movies like Io, because people want to see interesting stories. Like the Avatar, Way of the Water, felt way more artificial than Io. Io felt more like cinema, more like real life, because it has some emotion and some depth. Like, all the cartoony stuff, go away.
I hear that. But also, now you've got me really wanting this as a double feature. If somebody can manage to spend 7 hours at the movies, take a break in the middle, get some stretch, go to Din Tai Fung. Because I think they pair really well as stories of ambition. You know, I think in both of these movies, you really see artists saying, what is the most I can do? What is the most I can reach for? And doing it in radically different ways. And as long as the cinema winds up having that much of a range and everything we as audience members and critics and fans get to see, that's at least exciting, even if it is a lot of bro talk.
Well, it's never a lot of bro talk here with you two. So thank you so much. Have a great weekend. And if we don't speak before the new year, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. That was a great segment to end the year, like dead on. Like, wow.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Thanks, you guys. You guys are wonderful. So thank you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Amy. Hey, great pairing of movies. Like, it is what it is. We don't make them. We just review them.
All right. Amy Nicholson is the host of the podcast Unspooled, and she reviews for The New York Times. And Sean Edwards is an award-winning journalist for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri.
KCRW sponsors include Showtime, presenting The Corridors of Power. Director Dror Morey examines how American diplomats have responded to global atrocities since the fall of the Soviet Union, featuring interviews with world leaders, now playing in select theaters.
Well, more along the lines of EO. Coming up, we'll have an appreciation of Sight and Sound's best movie of all time. It's called Jean Dielman. It was made by the Belgian director Chantal Ackerman in 1975. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Since 1952, every 10 years, Sight and Sound magazine puts out a list of the top 100 greatest films of all time. This year, they polled about 1,600 film critics, academics, and writers, and something interesting happened. For the first time, a female filmmaker took the top spot. Chantal Ackerman's 1975 movie, Jean Dielman. It overtook last year's winner, which was Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, which held the top spot for 5 decades. Ackerman's film was on the list previously, but it was in 36th place. The film is a slow, quiet, slice-of-life depiction of a widowed woman going about her daily tasks, mainly inside her small apartment. She's cooking and she's cleaning. She's constantly moving. There's not a lot of dialogue, and it clocks in at more than 3 hours. Here to talk about it is Alicia Malone. She is host of TCM, Turner Classic Movies, and she's also the author of several books, including The Female Gaze, Essential Movies Made by Women. Alicia, welcome back to Press Play.
Hi, it's so great to be back.
Great to have you. All right. So you are a fan of this movie, I assume.
Yes.
That's why we're talking to you about it, and you know a lot about it. For people who haven't seen it, talk about who this woman is, Jean Dielman, and what she's doing day after day in her apartment.
Yes, this is a very demanding film. As you said, it's quite slow. It takes its time. It definitely doesn't have the sort of fast-paced editing and the cadence that we're used to watching in films right now. But if you can let yourself get mesmerized in it, you will be absorbed. So Jean Dielman, she is a single mother, and she's also a sex worker, and she goes about her daily life. We watch her over 3 days, and we get to know her routines. She's someone who is very tightly controlled. She's very organized. She does things in the same way every day. And so once you start to watch exactly what she's doing, and again, not many cuts, as long takes, the camera is very still as we're just observing her go about her day, you start to get to know her routine. And so when something goes awry, we won't spoil what that is, it feels disastrous. It feels catastrophic when suddenly her very ordered life goes out of order, when she forgets to turn off the radio, or if she burns her potatoes. I mean, it's all things that just seem very everyday. But once you start to watch her and you realize what it means when things are out of control, it does feel like something quite catastrophic and disastrous.
Yes, something ominous on the horizon when she wakes up on one of the mornings and she buttons her robe and she forgets to button one button.
Exactly. And something I love that Chantal Akerman, the director, talked about in terms of this film is that she wanted to elevate a woman's domestic life to high drama, to, you know, something akin to a car chase or a kiss in movies, that a woman's daily life should be examined in the same way and held to the same regard as films that have tropes that we often think of as being very masculine. You may not like it, but you will have an experience one way or another.
Absolutely. Well, I absolutely loved it. And I have to say, I didn't watch it all in one sitting. And I regret doing that because I think that's part of it, that you have to actually feel the way she does, the monotony in a way and the restlessness, the sort of feeling trapped in one place of it,
yes,
rather than watch it in chunks on your TV and turn it on and off and go about your daily chores. But it really did, at the end of it, make me question and think about the daily things that I do and what the meaning of them is. So you tossed off kind of casually that she's a sex worker. Let's revisit that, because in a way it was appropriate for you to toss it off, because she kind of tosses it off. It doesn't seem that important. It just seems like part of her daily activities, like peeling the potatoes. So at every day she welcomes in a different gentleman at a certain time. And I just want to play a clip from the movie. Again, there's not a lot of dialogue in this movie, so you're not going to hear much. Okay, so he says, see you next Thursday, and hands her money, and that's it. Mm. Talk about what is happening there. Why is she entertaining male clients?
Yeah, well, you get the sense that she is in a particular financial position, that she needs to make money, and perhaps that she doesn't see, you know, giving over her sexuality in that way as being anything terrible. It is, like you said, just treated as one of the tasks that she does throughout the day. And you never see what goes on camera. They go into a room, the door closes, you're left to imagine what happens in there. And I think that part of this whole film, you feel the presence of Chantal Akerman just observing this life, this woman behind the camera just taking in all this life. And, you know, perhaps she needed to do that, you know, to make money, or she just, yeah, this is the way that she's chosen to be able to do it. She has a baby as well. I mean, she's got a lot going on in her own life that maybe she couldn't have an everyday job.
Right. So she has this son who goes off to school every day, and she gives him money as he heads off. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back at the end of her day, and they have dinner together, pretty silent dinner. And then at the end, he goes to bed at the end of day one, and they have a conversation. They have a pretty long conversation. Mm-hmm. And he asks her, how did you meet my father, and why did you marry him? And let's hear a little bit from their conversation.
Tu avais envie de faire l'amour avec lui?
Les ballets, tu sais, ça n'avait aucune importance, ça ne faisait rien.
So basically, they're having a conversation where he asks why she would want to have sex with someone she didn't find attractive. She said her husband, his father, was ugly. And he says, well, if I were a woman, I could never make love with someone with whom I wasn't deeply in love. And she says, how could you know? You're not a woman. And then that's it. That's the end of the scene, which is pretty great. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and what that conversation says about Jean Dillman.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the great things about this film is that it is quite ambiguous. There's a lot left unsaid, and there's a lot that is not explained in the film. You're left to imagine, yes, why she takes on clients. And one thing, you know, she sort of implies is that she used her good looks for her husband, and that didn't work out very well for her economically. So it seems like she's using her looks now as a way to at least make money from it. But it seems like she has no issue with sexuality, and that she knows that he, the son, can't quite understand what it's like for a woman who sometimes, and probably more so in the 70s, but even now, sometimes the only power that you have and your only value is your beauty or your sexuality.
So why do you think that this was now voted as the best movie of all time by Sight and Sound?
It's about time, I say. I mean, these polls, these film canons, for so long they have been dominated by male directors and great work by men, but it engenders this idea that Hollywood is a place for men and that film belongs to men and not to women, and that the work of women, much like Jean Dujardin's domestic work, is not worthy of examination. It's not on the same level. So I think now that we have gone through Me Too, we've had many more conversations about gender inequality in all industries, and especially film, and we see more female filmmakers finally getting awarded, getting Oscars, getting opportunities, that now the people that they're polling, hopefully, I think they're probably a more diverse bunch as well, the people that are contributing to this list, but also just having more of a broader understanding that female directors have always been around and they've always contributed great work. They just haven't been as widely shown as other directors.
Well, Alicia, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show today to talk about Jean Dujardin.
Thank you so much. It's always fun to talk about this film and to talk to you.
Yes, thank you. Alicia Malone, host on TCM, Turner Classic Movies, and her latest book is called Girls on Film, Lessons from a Life of Watching Women in Movies. And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Marcel Hutchins. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. And our technical director is the ever super Mario Saavedra. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you for listening. I will see you on Monday.